We are learning about how to build a more inclusive workplace here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Companies of all sizes have denounced racism, intolerance, and exclusion, but taking a stand isn't enough. We're discussing how to put words into action with a consultant who helps organizations build cultural competence, bring diversity to white boards, to mentor women in leadership roles when men have always dominated the C-suite, right? Do you work for an organization that is actively working on its diversity and inclusion goals? What is going on with workplace equity? How is this reflected in the culture of your organizations? What stories can you share? Wins and setbacks. It's 800-642-1234. Alnissa Allgood founded the Madison-based nonprofit Collaboration for Good, focused on building social good in the region. Alnissa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. Nice to meet you, Kate.
Nice to meet you. What do companies mean when they say diversity in the workplace?
Well, I think what a lot of companies mean is that they want more people of color in their workplace because they've heard that it can create increase their level of innovation and overall corporate wealth for that. And that is definitely, I think, a potential of diversity in the workplace. And I think that's true for both for-profits and nonprofits. But I think with nonprofits, it's also slightly different. They're more interested in diversity because of they're typically serving more diverse communities than their organization is. Right. So in the nonprofit sector, you frequently end up with a mostly white organization providing services to a predominantly black neighborhood or a predominantly Latino neighborhood or things like that.
And explain the disconnect there and why that is so problematic.
The biggest problem with that, I believe, is just the fact that people don't really understand like basic kind of components of the people they serve. They basically attribute a lot of negative aspects to things that are everyday situations in various neighborhoods. So people end up creating like systems that penalize people for what like a black community or a neighborhood or a school system for what might be like an everyday occurrence in mm-hmm. the people or in that neighborhood. You know, like examples from like now, like is that we're going, students are going back to school virtually, right? And now you're starting to hear all of like the stories of little kids who are getting expelled and penalized for things that really shouldn't matter in like a virtual situation, like the young boy who got expelled from his school because his little brother brought in a BB gun in the same room that he was in and then fell with it, and he took it from his brother and set it aside, and they expelled him. It's like, why, right? But they created a policy like, you know, no guns in schools, not even BB guns or toy guns or water guns or things like that. And the teacher ultimately had the ability to just ignore it, right, because it wasn't really the kid's fault.
And when you say guns here, it reminds me that we are living in a time of police brutality, and there have been so many protests over the injustices, racial injustices, and the inequities to African Americans and to all people of color. As companies look inward at this time, do you find that this is a moment to seize on for corporations, for nonprofits alike, that they will start to make changes inside their organizations?
I think it is, and I think a lot of people want to do so. I believe what needs to happen is they need to stop looking at things like numbers, checklists, and things like that, and really start examining organizational culture, organizational policies and procedures, what things does your organization consider standard and normal and prevalent, and how do those things actually affect people of color? Because I think a lot of the stuff that a lot of corporations and a lot of individuals just consider normal and that they want other people to follow into are things that actually are incredibly off-putting to people of color and immigrants kind of across the board, like, you know, across the spectrum of things. It's like, you know, people say they want more black people in their organization or more people in color in general in their organization. They want diversity, but then they technically want all of those people to act white.
Right. So, and kind of the code switching, if you will, which we've mm-hmm. heard about in the past, and this idea that you change who you are to be able to fit in to the situation you're in.
Right. And I think people of color and immigrants and stuff and other people do that quite a bit. And I'm not anti a certain level of code switching because we all end up in different situations and we need to fit in those situations. Like, you don't bring the same attitude to going out with friends that you do to, like, you know, the corporation that you work with or the organization that you work with, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so there's a fair amount of code switching in, I think, life in general. But in the workplace, it becomes something that's far more penalized. It's kind of like, well, we hired so-and-so, and they're just not fitting in, or, you know, and, like, and then the reasoning behind, like, of why they are not fitting in might just be things based off of what they consider normal. Like, well, we expect them to be in at 7 instead of 8, even though the work time starts at 8, right? But all of our other people are coming in at 7 or 7:30. We expect them to go out to drinks with us and be friendly and go play golf and things like that. And it's not like people of color won't make some of those efforts, but, like, let's, you know, be honest about it. It's, you know,
if they're if it's unwritten to the policies of, you know, whether it's in their job description or otherwise, it certainly may not be clear what, you know, what is being expected and whether it's within even boundaries.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it's not clear. It's not written. It's not necessarily expected, but then it's also very off-putting as well. It's like, because, yes, more black people are playing golf, but let's face it, most black people don't really want to play golf, right? for that. I mean, so it's about even the activities that are chosen for how people build connections with each other inside
networking.
The workplace, right?
Yeah. We're talking with Alnisa Allgood, who consults with nonprofits, connecting community responsibility and entrepreneurship, helping companies with diversity and inclusion goals. We're talking about transforming workplace culture focused on diversity and inclusion and what you have seen at your organization. What is changing? 800-642-1234 is the number to join in. Alnisa, how would you define inclusion in the workplace?
I define inclusion as having, you still have standards, but accepting people where they are and for who they are in the workplace. So, you know, we work with sometimes like people who just don't like to speak up in meetings, right? And sometimes, like, you know, people will force people to do this. And my thought is there is that line between when you need to determine, is it the situation that's making a person uncomfortable, or is it a component, or is there unwillingness to speak up just about their nature, somehow. Maybe they prefer to speak up one-to-one, right? Or during the aside, like, I don't want to embarrass somebody in this meeting, but I do want to tell you this, like, I don't agree with this person's idea, and here's why, right? and sometimes, I mean, and those type of things take effort and energy and constant monitoring, right? Like, everybody wants like a quick checklist, you know. I hired more Black people, I hired more women, we have a few people with disabilities here, we're done. Diversity, you know.
Checking the boxes, solved. So to speak. Okay, yeah.
And it's not. It's this ongoing effort to make sure that people feel a part of your organization, and to keep identifying when something sets people apart from each other, whether it's like the way you congratulate people, the way you, you know, enforce policies, or even just your policies and procedures themselves. I think for a lot of organizations, all of the things that you, if you didn't start out with diversity and inclusion efforts and with a diverse team in your first 3 years of your organization, it's really, really hard to add it after the fact because all your policies and procedures, your organizational culture, and tons of like little things are all working against you because you've created them predominantly for the, you know, who, the predominant people in your organization, which is maybe mostly white people, right? and then so these things then fight against your efforts, and people don't acknowledge that those things are fighting against their efforts. They just think more people, this should make it better, and it doesn't.
We're talking about diversity, equity, inclusion in the workplace with social entrepreneur Alnisa Allgood. How transparent is your organization about the steps it's taking to become more diverse and encourage inclusive practices? Is it more talk than action, or are you noticing a change in your workplace? What's happening at work? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Alnisa Allgood here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing how to create a more equitable workplace here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Black Lives Matter movement for racial justice, it's sparked worldwide demonstrations. And business leaders, they're looking inward and being more deliberate with diversity, equity, and inclusion goals in the wake of the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. Is your company creating opportunities to listen to the voices directly from grassroots or young leaders, underserved, marginalized people within the organization, within your community? Do you sit on the board of a company or a nonprofit? How is your board addressing issues of systemic racism and injustice? Join in your perspective right here, 800-642-1234. Alnisa Allgood is Executive Director of Nonprofit Tech and founder of Collaboration for Good, and she stays with us for the hour. Alnisa, I want to divulge something here that, you know, my first foray into the job world, one of my first internships was with the Minnesota Women's Press. And back in the day, it was a newspaper, but a newspaper by, for, and about women, of course, run completely by women. What does having and working in a diverse workplace, or maybe a workplace that is all women, perhaps, what does that tell others about an organization?
Well, I mean, to some degree, I think it's dependent on if the organization was deliberately created around those components. It basically tells the outside world, like a woman's press, it tells people that women matter and that we're putting the focus on them and their ideas and their thoughts, and we want to push that information out into the world about what things in terms of how women see politics or everyday life or a variety of other types of things is interesting and it matters and can be world-changing, that there's innovation that can be found or discovered in, like, those areas. And I think with diverse workplaces, you get similar things, but it's a little bit more subtle for that. So if your workplace is truly diverse and also inclusive, you're starting to create a culture where people can question, like, their own bias and still feel comfortable doing that. So you're expanding the boundaries of what is comfortable for people, what things they think about, how they work on projects and work together on projects with people of different races or people of different nationalities. You know, I think it gives people the opportunity to widen their experience and open their mind and to stop accepting that, well, this is just how it's done, because things are never just how they're done. Things are done differently everywhere around the world. And even in a country like the United States, changes from state to state or even areas of various states can be, like, mind-blowing for people, especially if you've never left your hometown or the city that you were born and raised in. Like, you know, so everybody gets this different idea of what they consider normal, but they don't necessarily take the time and opportunity to think about how are other people doing this? How are other places tackling these issues, these problems, and things like that? And I think that type of ability to question, that just to ask those types of questions and then to look for answers for them open up just a wide range of innovation possibilities for the people in your organization, but for your organization as well.
As you talk about these, what is standard and normal and prevalent inside the organization, I'm wondering, do you work with companies that may be in denial, that say, you know what, we are a welcoming place. I don't understand what's going on, why we wouldn't be considered welcoming. Why should we change? Is it difficult to break through that mindset?
I think so, yes. I mean, we work with, I think, a number of companies who, you know, I think American culture is so caught up in this good terminology, you know, and that's a little bit ironic seeming that, you know, my business is called, like, Collaboration for Good, and I work in the social good.
There's also that last name, but
right, my last name, all good. But we're so focused in on wanting to identify or be identified as a good person that people overlook, like, the things that we do that aren't really good or bad, in like, and, like, being a good person isn't a static thing, right? Good people do bad things. Good people make mistakes, right? You know.
They're human.
Yeah, you're human. Like, and it's an ongoing struggle to, like, be good, because the world is changing and everything is changing and you have to keep readjusting to your life. So I think with corporations and stuff, this becomes even more true. Like, they want, you know, various nonprofits or corporations, social enterprises, they want to be known for a diverse workplace, that we want people, you know, diverse people in our culture, but they don't necessarily want to change their corporate culture. Like, I, you know, and then to some degrees, some corporations are working on that, like, unconscious bias training is, like, one of the new kind of steps that, like, corporations are taking. You know, they're basically also doing training on, like, new ways of decision making, trying to create employee resource groups and things like that. But I'm always particularly interested in the unconscious bias training.
What do you see there? Yeah, go ahead.
For one thing, I actually think it's a good effort for people to recognize when they're bringing bias into a situation. But what I haven't necessarily been seeing is that making a difference in how the corporation as an entity responds to different situations. It's more like, we're going to train up our people, but we're not really going to change our corporate culture, right?
So there's a disconnect. It's not connecting.
Right. You know, I mean, and over time, my thought is like, if you kept all of your employees and they all were super gung-ho and they all started working their way up the ladder in a top-down corporate experience, eventually change would happen. Those situations are almost never true, you know. Most places are losing employees at some percentage every year. The people who probably get the most out of the unconscious bias training are probably the people who are going to leave sooner, and they most likely weren't the people who were going to make it up to the different suite levels anyway. And so you basically get a corporate culture that stays the same while you get people who were trained to do better and they move elsewhere to do better.
I want to reintroduce you. Alnisa Allgood organizes Madison's nonprofit Draft Day, which is an event that attracts more diverse candidates to nonprofit boards, including women, people of color, and people with disabilities. We're talking with her about workplace diversity, what it means. She's executive director of Nonprofit Tech, founder of Collaboration for Good. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Alnisa, let's talk about boards. Boards of directors, what needs to happen to make them, not just all white people sitting around a boardroom table? What can an organization do to reflect changes to their board of directors?
Yeah, and so that's an interesting one, because most boards, especially nonprofit boards, they start out with people you know, right? Mm-hmm. So people recruit their family members or their friends to serve on their board because they've decided that they're going to start up an organization they're gung-ho about. Changing the world, changing their neighborhood, getting more people to recycle, whatever it is that they're super gung-ho about. And your friends are the easy step, right? The people you know are like easy access to. You can persuade them to come to board meetings, have conversations with you, and you'll buy them a beer after the meeting, right? And you want to hang out with them. But I think as you're growing, and I would actually argue even when you're starting up, you want to start actually thinking about how can we create a diverse board and why does a diverse board matter for our organization, right? And to potentially move yourself away from the idea that each person on the board is fulfilling a specific role. Like, I need a lawyer, I need a finance person, I need, you know, and things like that. That's still going to happen, but I think when you start building a board that, you know, you're looking at people from different races and ethnicities, different genders, different abilities, even different age ranges, because that's also a really big deal on boards as well. Is like, you'll notice that a lot of boards are made of people over the age of 50. Right?
And I would also throw in there at different income levels. Oftentimes, board members are wealthy.
Right, exactly. You know, and that puts just blinders on about a variety of type of things. Is like, is your event accessible? It's like, people will be like, well, we have, you know, we have a front door that meets the accessibility code. We're good, right?
Well, we have to pause there with Alnisa Allgood, who consults with nonprofits. We will be back with her right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're discussing workplace equity here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There are only three black CEOs in the Fortune 500. Kenneth Frazier of pharmaceutical company Merck, Marvin Ellison of home improvement retailer Lowe's, and Roger Ferguson Jr. of financial services to our world of academia and government, TIAA. And this number is down from 7 less than a decade ago. And there are still no, by the way, no black women serving as a Fortune 500 CEO. All that accounting there from Business Insider. How do you make change? What needs to happen today to make workplaces promote a more diverse and inclusive culture? Is your company's recruitment and staff hiring pipeline changing? How are you doing that? 800-642-1234. Alnisa Allgood consults with nonprofits on capacity building, and she founded Collaboration for Good. She stays with us. Alnisa, we heard from Jim in Oshkosh, called in, couldn't stay with us, and Jim feels people don't take the implicit bias or the anti-bias training seriously, and they only give answers they think the trainer wants to hear. And Jim is wondering, is this anti-bias training effective? Does it work?
I think it's probably dependent on who's doing it and why it's being used at various corporations or organizations. I wouldn't disagree with Jim on like that topic whatsoever. I've definitely seen in places where people are offering diversity training, unconscious bias training and things like that, where more than half of the people aren't really interested in being part of the training. And we've all been around long enough to basically know what it is that people want to hear from us and give it to people for it. You know, I mean, sorry, that was a lot of ums. But
that's
like
okay.
Last year I was doing a workshop at one of the Madison schools. I think it was a middle school. And it was interesting to me because it's the first time I had been into a middle school in like a really long time. and I was just like, but as I was walking through the school, all of the phrases around diversity, inclusion, and everything that in like that kind of realm of stuff was just littered all over the school's walls and like the rooms on flyers and things like that. And then it became like this interesting idea to me because I'm like, well, everybody talks about that, you know, the upcoming youth get diversity and inclusion, right? And that they want it. And I think that's true to some degree, that they're naturally more flexible around people of different races, different genders, different gender identities. Like there's a lot more fluidity in it. But all of a sudden, I was also just struck by the fact of how much of this do they actually really understand? Because it becomes easy to spit back words and phrases, especially when they're everywhere you go and you know people want you to say them, right?
But do they really
fit in, right?
Right. Do they really know the underlying terminology that they're seeing on the walls, or do they can they see it within their friendships or the words that they choose to use with others?
Exactly. I mean, it's like, is that really moving you to understand the hardships that, you know, one of your friends in your friend group? I mean, so you may have a more diverse friend group at that age, and I think that's definitely true, right? So that's a really nice thing, right?
That helps,
but
yes.
It's like, but do you understand what the actual problems are with why is it that, you know, if a cop comes into the school, the person that they're most likely to, you know, to confront and be incredibly confrontational with, you know, Jared, right? And, you know, because as far as you're concerned, Jared's cool and the cops just being bad, but do you understand like the history in that and like what it is in maybe the police training and like the police responses and what things the law has told the police that brings on those types of confrontation? And I think there's that's kind of missing in that people are trying to get away from. a lot. I mean, like, people don't really want to confront the history of the United States, right? people want to say that all things are equal for all people and that, you know, that's part of the Constitution and things like that. But really, it's not, right? And it's like, I'm like, do you forget that we had to add amendments to actually include black people and women and stuff and bring them into this framework because our original infrastructure did not. Our original infrastructure basically said that women and people of color, especially blacks, were all less than white people and landowners, and to most degrees they were considered chattel, like, or pieces of property that could be owned by other people in this country. And
so embedding that history and really having those kids understand that history and how it is presented and then how it is carried out at all levels of education, that sounds like what you're saying really forms a foundation where you can bridge into adult life how you would approach, say, anti-bias training.
Exactly, yes. and also how you would approach building a new organizational structure, if you were a new business structure or organizational structure, if you were going to go into business for yourself. And that's one of the things I think organizationally Collaboration for Good focuses in on when we're working with our social enterprises and when we're working with our social entrepreneurs. We want our social entrepreneurs to build businesses that are thinking about diversity and inclusion at the beginning, you know, at their early stages. And we also want that to include wage equity, because wage equity is really our big issue around that, because even if you exist in a country that still just ignores you and discourages you from doing things, if you have the capital, social capital, financial capital, and the ability to bypass a lot of the systems that are working against you, you have the ability then to start creating your own way forward in a country that would deny you things.
I want to pause right there on the issue of wage equity. We're talking with Alnisa Allgood, who consults with nonprofits in connecting community responsibility and entrepreneurship, helping companies with diversity and inclusion from the outset, from the get-go. We're discussing how to make organizations more inclusive, where we go from here with your insights. 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Tom, who's joining us from Marshfield. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Go ahead.
Well, I feel like this issue is kind of forcing racism, because the more you bring it up, the more you make it an issue. People naturally want to do the right thing. And we don't need to write amendments and things like that. We would have allowed those things. But things like women's suffrage caused inequality in ways of diluting the work pool. So now when a woman has a right to choose to stay home and is equally as valued for staying home, a man cannot work and support her right to stay home. And I just feel like the more that you say that there's bias, and the more you push these things, the more there is bias, and the more that you're promoting that kind of thinking.
Well,
a man or a woman's right to stay home.
Let's have Alnisa jump in here, because wage equity, certainly we're hearing this in Tom's response there.
Yes, and I have to say, Tom, I would disagree with you across the board on your statement, and for these reasons. One, these issues exist, and like, just not talking about them don't stop them from existing in the world. It's like not talking about the husband who beats his wife and everybody in the neighborhood knows that he beats his wife. It doesn't go away. It doesn't actually stop the issues from happening. It does mean every evening that you have a woman afraid that her husband might beat her or unintentionally kill her, but not talking about it doesn't actually stop it from happening, and it doesn't increase the frequency of it happening. So I think that applies also to racism in the country. This country is incredibly racist. It has always been, and we can accept that to a certain level of degree, and that's not saying that you don't want to change it, but accepting that something exists and is the first step to actually making it better. Denying it is not a step forward. Denying it is like hiding in the closet while mommy's being like punched around by daddy, right? and that's something that is, I think, beneficial for little kids. But as a country, we're an adult now, and we need to have adult responses to these types of actions and these types of incurrences, and we need to address our past, and we need to do so systematically and thoroughly and with an open mind on what our country is going to look like after we do that. People want to say we want to address some of these stuff, but they want to keep things to the same. They don't want change. And wanting change means that you need to get a certain amount of familiarity with being uncomfortable and not knowing what the next step is, right? Because you can't predict every step out, but you also can't deny your very existence in this world either. And so, and I think Tom was talking about wage equity or economic equity or women, really more so women in
women
the workforce.
In the workforce. And let's pause there with women in the workforce. Alnisa Allgood, our guide to workplace diversity, equity, and inclusion. We'll be back with her in just a minute. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Alnisa Allgood about diversity in the workplace. Numbers here to bear in mind from these research and advisory firms. According to Deloitte, diverse companies have 2.3 times higher cash flow per employee. Gartner surveyed HR leaders this spring, found nearly 90% feel their organization has been ineffective or flat at increasing diversity representation. Still time for your thoughts on workplace diversity and inclusion efforts. We have Alnisa Allgood, founder of Coalition for Good, and she stays with us. Alnisa, you know, here in the pandemic, you know, families are faced with really difficult choices. Women are often bearing the brunt, trying to educate their children and stay at work and in their jobs. What are you seeing out there, and what can be done for working families?
Oh, yeah, it's a mess out there. What I've been hearing, because obviously I'm not seeing much from this, is that, yeah, there's basically been starting to be another kind of level of workplace upward mobility that is excluding women, and like pay, of course, has always been an issue, and that's growing. I think a growing divide again up under the pandemic stuff. Like, people are evaluating men's responses to the pandemic a bit more, and like their ability to navigate Zoom calls and things like that, and they're putting more pressure, I think, on women to not only do that, but then they're valuing them less when they do it well. And they're also saying you need to make sure that your kids are in school, that you're either self-teaching them if you're not sending them to school, or, I mean, and just the way, like, the new current hybrid school systems or all virtual school systems are set up also just means parents in general need to take a much larger participatory factor in their kids' education, and that has historically fallen to women, and I think that's still true, right? That, you know, that mothers are, like, taking the brunt of those policy changes. What can be done, I think, in, like, the home, I mean, in this virtual workplace or the work-from-home culture, That I have to honestly say I don't know, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, because the biggest issue is how do you solve, for a family that has children, how do you solve the issue of your kids getting a better or at least the same education, like a better or the same education while they're, you know, while they're in these virtual situations that just don't command their attention, aren't as experiential, and in some ways are also more invasive around, you know, the things that they don't have to bring to school, right? Mm-hmm. Let's face it, like, you know, as much as like school can be an incredible hardship for our youth, is there's also like that opportunity of like the things that you get to leave behind in your home. So if mommy and daddy fight constantly, you get to leave that behind, right? If, you know, your brother or your sister gets the most attention for whatever reasons, because there are legitimate reasons that sometimes one child needs more attention than the other, you get to leave that behind when you go to school. So there's all of these things that these opportunities that school offers on top of like these like penalties that they apply against like children as well. For that. And I don't know. You know, I can't say that I have an answer for that. There are definitely better people in the world. And even here in Madison, Wisconsin, who are thinking about, I think, these concepts of how do you, you know, create more value for a virtual school situation? How do you remove some of that responsibilities from a mother's shoulders, especially if it's a working mom? And a lot of families have working moms now. Most people need two incomes to keep their lifestyles and their livelihood going. So it's not always an option of, well, the mom should just like remove herself from like the workforce and focus in on the kids, right?
We're talking with Alnisa Allgood, who is the founder of Collaboration for Good. She's executive director of nonprofit tech. We're looking at workplaces now and efforts for diversity and inclusion. With your thoughts, let's bring in Bill joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. Whether Ms. Allgood knows it or not, she actually has put her hand right on the solution of this national problem, and that is education. I'm a professional educator and have been one for a long time. John Dewey said, "We build Americans in public school." And what has happened? Public school has been dramatically underfunded. The only way we can save our nation is to start with the children and to pay particular attention to secondary school just before they leave. I think it's vital that we help the families and we help our nation. This nation is being run by a bunch of big fat cats.
All right. Well, Bill, I want to have Alnisa be able to respond to that. As we've been talking about here, Alnisa, you know, looking at the younger children and as they grow up, those are the future of our workforce.
It's true, and I do agree with Bill. Like, public education is actually, I think, one of the responses to these issues. But I'm also cautious around that because systematically over the years, public education has not just been defunded, it has also been kind of pushed into a direction of not teaching about hard lessons in history. You know, I was speaking to someone on TikTok, you know, platform where I had watched a video and I was trying that this person was talking about, and I was trying to understand where she was coming from. So I wrote a comment, and as we were kind of just going quickly back and forth, I all of a sudden came to the realization that she had been taught and absolutely believed that slavery wasn't bad for black people because they got fed and they had a place to work, and that it wasn't an ownership issue. It was a work issue. And that's kind of what, like, the teachers were pushing out. I mean, and obviously this isn't across the board in every state, but it does concern me that a lot of our educational materials come out of the state of Texas, right? because a lot of it is like kind of whitewashing, I think, history. And like, you know, and that I think also needs to stop. But I do believe the educational system has a strong component in changing this.
Yeah, and only so we are very short on time here, but mm-hmm. if organizations and nonprofits could take one step today in the direction to help improve their culture, help improve how inclusive they are, what would they do?
I would say put together a diverse committee, and actively try and find a diverse committee of people from different ages, different ethnicities, races, maybe even different locations from the country or from in the world, and have them review all your organization's policies and procedures, because I think one of the things that actively fights against diversity in the organization are like policies, procedures, and corporate culture. And it's hard to make changes when you have systems in place that are actively fighting against you.
So going back to where we started with those standards, normal, what's prevalent, really taking those apart and looking more closely at them.
Exactly.
Alnisa, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Alnisa Allgood is founder of Collaboration for Good. She's executive director of Nonprofit Tech. And we have a link to Mercer's report. It's called Let's Get Real About Equality When Women Thrive 2020 Global Report. That's at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, it's 1A. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.